This bloody jealousy of city against city, of party against party, this murderous greed of those little wars, the tiger-like triumph over the corpse of the slain enemy. In short, the incessant renewal of those Trojan scenes of struggle and of horror, in the spectacle of which, as a genuine Hellene, Homer stands before us absorbed with delight. Whither does this naive barbarism of the Greek state point? What is its excuse before the tribunal of eternal justice? Proud and calm, the state steps before this tribunal, and by the hand it leads the flower of blossoming womanhood, Greek society. For this Helen, the state waged those wars, and what gray-bearded judge could here condemn? Hello, my name is Ryan Hamill, and this is New Humanist, the podcast of the Ancient Language Institute. I'm joined by Jonathan Roberts, my co-host and co-founder of the Ancient Language Institute. We are on a quest to discover what a renewed humanism looks like for the modern world. And we're back with another preface to an unpublished and unwritten book by Friedrich Nietzsche. If you remember, in our last episode, we covered another one of these prefaces to an unwritten book, Homer's Contest, that dealt with the question of the agon, the contest in the Greek polis, and how that helps explain Homer. And we actually spent most of the time looking at Hesiod and talking about eros, envy, and jealousy in the city. And this is kind of a natural next step. This is another one of these prefaces that Nietzsche sent five of these to the Wagners, Richard Wagner, the opera composer, and his wife. And this one is called The Greek State. And so it's less directly concerned with poetry and Homer per se, but clearly, as you heard in the opening, Nietzsche's still thinking about Homer, about the Iliad especially, and why these humane, liberal Greeks loved this poem of slaughter so very much. And so we're going to cover a lot of ground here, and I think it'd be good to lay out the argument, because there's definitely some interesting moves and interesting connections with previous stuff that we've talked about.
Well, on the note of connections, I think it's interesting that on the previous episode, we determined that one of the targets that Nietzsche has in mind is this view of kind of inescapable progress. Things are just getting better. Civilization is inescapable, and you will soon escape nature, right? And we talked about how those terms are being used.
I think he called it, sorry to interrupt, he had a great phrase for it, the flabby concept of humanity.
That's right. Yeah, the flabby concept of humanity. So if you have this idea that things are just automatically going to get better, you're flabby. You're on the side of the flabby. And one of the things that he opens up here is he points out that we in some ways find ourselves superior to the ancients in a certain sense, or at least we think of ourselves as being superior. And he discusses slavery. It's like, yeah, look, we now look down on slavery. And so we think we're better because they had slavery. And it's interesting to consider that. Because, you know, slavery is one of those terms that we immediately have images of, you know, the transatlantic slave trade and things like that. But if we think about slavery in the ancient world, there was two main ways in which you could become a slave. One is through warfare. You know, your city gets destroyed and you get captured. And so the word servus means someone who has been preserved, someone who has been saved to serve. Servus, servatus.
Servus being Latin for slave.
Right. And so you could become a slave through warfare, or you could become a slave through debt. So if you owe someone big time and are constantly giving them the fruits of your labor, you're a slave. And those, if you think about those definitions, there's a really good chance that a huge segment of society would qualify as being a slave in terms of that second category because of the nature of debt.
You're saying today?
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, we do have bankruptcy law, though, which kind of eliminates eternal debt peonage, except for student loans, which aren't dischargeable in bankruptcy. So if you have student loans, those don't go away until you die. So maybe you're a slave if you have student loans.
All that to say, this notion of slavery and thinking that we have just set it aside altogether might be a little bit more complicated depending on how that term is being used, which means that you can't just automatically pull out the triumphalistic card of, yeah, we're superior to the ancients, even in this regard.
Right. And well, and so what do we have instead of slavery? Why can we not have slavery, at least in our own minds? Nietzsche says, because of the dignity of man, he puts these in scare quotes, the dignity of man and the dignity of labor. And I mean, I've always kind of thought that dignity is kind of a wishy-washy word that gets used in philosophical and political discourse. It's kind of like rights. If you kind of know that calling something a right is just a fancy way of saying, I think it's good. Well, healthcare is a human right because it's good. And so you're like, well, okay, I don't want to talk about rights. So we'll talk about human dignity instead of human rights. And it's like, well, that's just a wishy-washy word about what you think is good that starts with the letter D instead of the letter R. I really think there's much of a difference. So that one already strikes me as wishy-washy. And Nietzsche clearly agrees.
Well, it's funny because my own, you know, personal relationship with the word dignity might be a little bit different.
And that, tell us your personal relationship with dignity.
So when I think of dignity, I automatically think that that is something that very few people possess. And that I think of someone who's like dignified, worthy of reverence. And so I think of some sort of social station that someone possesses either by the nature of, you know, their merits or their station in society.
Well, you're a proper aristocrat already. I think this is the problem. This is your problem with reading Nietzsche, is you read him attacking this stuff and you're like, I don't know what he's talking about. Like, what's he going on about? Because you're already living in the kind of Ubermensch reality that he's pushing for. You're already there.
It's this is what happens when you're born in Mexico and don't have a flabby concept of humanity. Yeah, rights, that can also be along. We might have to find a good reading on rights to discuss that fully, because it's a much abused term. I was trying to come up with a joke when you start to discuss rights. You know, what is a right? I'll tell you when we find a new one.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's kind of my personal relationship with the word dignity. It's just kind of a fancy way of saying rights when you know that talking about rights is a bit silly. But, you know, I think if the dignity of man, or which just seems like a kind of dressed up way of saying human rights, if that's a little suspect, because like based on what, you know, we could at least agree, oh, the dignity of labor, you know, work is good. It keeps you occupied, makes you strong. It provides for you and your family, your community, you're building something good. Now, we could agree labor is dignified, right? At least useful labor. You know, maybe a BS job isn't dignified, but, you know, if you're, whether you're a farmer, a teacher, or a doctor, a carpenter, you know, you're doing something real that's dignified.
Apparently, BS job is a technical category. I've seen a few headlines talking about the rise of the BS job, things like that.
Yeah. I got that from The Economist. They did a big thing a while back about these people who realize, like, yeah, I have this job that pays me money, but I'm not actually doing anything.
Yeah, when I was reading this, you know, given our context at the Ancient Language Institute, you know, we assign work, right, to students. And this is something that we've put a fair bit of thought into, is that what sort of work do we give our students? And we want it to be the sort of work that helps them reach particular goals. And we're fairly convinced that there are kinds of work that don't do that. And we've critiqued some of that work as being, you know, life crushing, worthless, and even just a waste of life because it's a waste of time.
Yeah.
So even in the very narrow context of academic pursuit and pursuit of learning, pursuit of wisdom, there are kinds of work that don't have positive value to put it that way. That seems to be clear.
Nietzsche goes farther. To him, labor has no claim on titles of honor, because all it is the outworking of an impulse to exist at any price. And existence is misery. And so it's just the meaningless prolongation of misery. So labor has no dignity. And so we want to give an overview of the argument. This is really where it starts, is that existence is per se worthless, and therefore labor is of no inherent value. And therefore labor is shameful, actually. And that includes, kind of shockingly, even artistic labor. And this is Nietzsche's argument about the Greeks, the Greek mindset. You know, human life is not really valuable in and of itself. Therefore, prolonging it or enabling it by labor isn't kind of worthwhile. And we talked last time about the influence of Jacob Burckhardt on Nietzsche, the historian and kind of friend and kind of mentor. And he wrote, well, his lectures on the Greeks were compiled into a book, The Greeks and Greek Civilization. I highly recommend it. Amazing book. And it's clear that Nietzsche here is drawing on Burckhardt when he says, just to give a flavor of kind of how shocking this might seem to us, given what we know of Greek art, which is so stunning and amazing, you say, well, the sculptors and the poets, they must have been really honored. Here's what Nietzsche says. In one place, Plutarch, with earlier Greek instinct, says that no nobly born youth, on beholding the Zeus in Pisa, would have the desire to become himself a Phidias, or on seeing the Hera in Argos, to become himself a Polyclete. And just as little would he wish to be Anacreon, Philetus, or Archilochus, however much he might revel in their poetry. To the Greek, the work of the artist falls just as much under the undignified conception of labor as any ignoble craft.
So even Homer in his craft of laboring to create the epics, the work itself is just has no intrinsic value. It's nice once it's done because you have a great work. But it's the process that it took is shameful. It's a disgrace. That's what Nietzsche has to say about how the Greeks would see this.
Yes. So if labor itself to the Greeks is not dignified in any way, can any kind of dignity or elevation be attained? What sets humans apart? What is higher? This was kind of the issue in Homer's contest, the very beginning. We talked about this quite a bit. Nietzsche argues that humans aren't superior to or above nature. Anything you think of as humanity is just nature. So is there a way for humans to kind of transcend just being a menial slave? I mean, even in the beginning of Greek state, he says that, you know, even plants will send their roots out through rock in order to get water so they can survive. That's just what work is. Forget about being superior to the beasts. You're not even superior to a weed. And so the answer is, for Nietzsche, that the indignity of labor, kind of paradoxically, namely slavery, is actually what produces, almost by accident, this higher life. The surplus of goods, I guess, produced by slavery enables culture. And that is what is truly human and not shameful. And Nietzsche's under no illusions about how this sounds. to the reader. He says, "We must accept this cruel sounding truth that slavery is of the essence of culture. A truth, of course, which leaves no doubt as to the absolute value of existence." So existence itself is not very valuable because the vast majority of people are going to be slaves. And the whole point of that really is just to produce a surplus so that a small elite group gets to enjoy culture. So you may not like it, but that's what existence is, according to Nietzsche.
So the true dignity, it seems, is located in the enjoyment of culture, right? Not even in the production of cultural artifacts. In other words, even in this kind of schema of thinking, you have to consider like Homer is a slave, Plato is a slave, sculptors are slaves, the makers of music are slaves, and then the folks that get to really have some sort of value in their existence are the ones that can enjoy those products. Is that right?
Close. I think so. So listen to this line. "At their cost, the cost of the slaves, through the surplus of their labor, that privileged class is to be relieved from the struggle for existence in order to create and to satisfy a new world of want." So I think he would say that the producers of artistic culture are not on the same level of every other slave. I think they seem to be in this privileged class, but maybe they're the slaves of the privileged class. If you have like two segments of society, slaves proper, and then the privileged class. And within the privileged class, there's the kind of the manual workers, so poets and sculptors and stuff. And then on top of them are the people who really enjoy it. Because what's key here is this new world of want. It's rooted in a question of desire. So humans have desire to exist. That in itself is miserable. Existence has no value. But once you're relieved from the desire to exist, I mean, this is kind of like Maslow's hierarchy. Once you have food, then you ascend to the next level. And for Nietzsche, I think there's only two levels. The desire to exist, so you need what a monkey needs, you know, water, food, etc. And then if you can, through the surplus labor of slaves, ascend to the next level, you can experience the desire, the need, the want for art. And if you can have that satisfied, then you're really living.
So I think that that seems like a workable, you know, from a Nietzschean schema, a workable way of thinking about this. One of the things that holds me back from thinking that that's what Nietzsche has in mind, and maybe there's more to look at. But on the second page of our text, when and this might be in part of what you already read, where he says near the top, "To the Greek, the work of the artist falls just as much under the undignified conception of labor as any ignoble craft." So he seems to want to put them under the same category of undignified labor. It does seem to have a different relationship to the sustaining of existence, right? He's like, yeah, even the plants are trying to exist. So there is a difference between the farmer, right, and the artist. They're doing two different functions insofar as sustaining existence, but they're both doing labor, which falls under this kind of undignified category. At least that's how I'm taking this path.
Oh yeah, I don't think you're wrong, but it should be noted this is the same because this is all becoming. It's the same as begetting children. And he says, "As a father admires the beauty and the gift of his child, but thinks of the act of procreation with shamefaced dislike, so it was with the Greek." So all these acts of becoming in which you're operating according to instinct. And here's a great parallel with Eliot in Virgil. What was it? Virgil in the Christian World? Yeah. When he talks about inspiration, where the artist is kind of feels compelled to write or build or make something, it feels like it comes from outside him. Nietzsche would agree and said, yes, that is what's happening. Eliot wants to interpret that Christianly, some sort of divine or angelic spirit coming into him. Nietzsche thinks it's nature. He has an instinct to do it. And so insofar as the farmer plants in order to feed himself to sustain his existence, and the artist composes, they're both doing so according to instinct. However, and this is where I think it's fair to make the distinction explicit, even if it's implicit in Nietzsche, is that instinct of the farmer is relative to mere existence. That instinct operating within the artist is a new world of want. It's a different instinct, even though it is an instinct from nature. It's the instinct to contemplate art. Phidias or Anacreon, whoever, has to kind of like,
right.
We're not going to go take a tour of the workshop. That's private. Want anybody seeing that?
Yeah. So then you have, so the distinction is found within the instinct and not within
the end of the instinct.
Right. Not, it's not the labor that's where you find a distinction.
Right. Right. Yeah. The fact that you're laboring is shameful. However, you know, one is for mere existence, one is for the need for art. And so, you know, they're a little different in dignity.
Right. And so he has this phrase that you were wanting to elaborate on further, a new world of want. So it seems like the old world of want is the desire for mere survival.
Yes, that's common to anything alive.
Is the new world of want the contemplation of cultural artifacts?
I think it's the enjoyment of art. If you go up a few lines, he's talking about the Sphinx nature, who in the glorification of the artistically free culture life so beautifully stretches forth her virgin body culture, which is chiefly a real need for art. So I guess this new world of want available to the privileged class is culture. And what is culture? Chiefly the need for art. So there's probably more to it, but all of it, the stuff that are more on the fringes, all pointing towards the center, which is art. And you're not going to get that without slavery. And so this turns Nietzsche's eyes to the present. Compassion must then require the destruction of culture. Because if culture requires slavery, then the compassion that, you know, fights, that rejects and fights against slavery has to, in the end, reject culture. And here's what he says. The misery of toiling men must still increase in order to make the production of the world of art possible to a small number of Olympian men. Here is to be found the source of that secret wrath nourished by communists and socialists of all times, and also by their feebler descendants, the white race of the liberals, not only against the arts, but also against classical antiquity. This is the cry of compassion tearing down the walls of culture. I mean, I think you could sum this up as the whole kind of political fruit of the Enlightenment is ultimately at war with culture and culture's kind of seed, classical antiquity.
So Nietzsche's Olympian man, is he just like reading Homer, reading the Aeneid, looking at the greatest paintings? Is that what the Olympian man is doing? What's the Olympian man doing?
He's doing that, but he's also engaged in the contest, in Homer's contest. The Greeks are addicted to competition. So he's going to the Olympics, the Olympian Games, and wrestling and hurling discuses and racing, driving chariots. And then, as we'll see at the end of this essay or preface, he's also a soldier.
So is the training required for military service and competition in the game, does that count as labor?
Well, it's certainly not the struggle for existence.
Right.
Because there's nothing about wrestling that helps you exist. And it's actually this massive expenditure of time and energy to do something unnecessary. And so this is, you know, true otium. It's true leisure. There's no need to do this, but you just spend all your time and money and energy doing it. Same with war. I mean, war is killing. It's the opposite of trying to exist.
Right. Yeah, that sounds right. I don't know that rules out these activities falling under the category of labor, since the way that he's defined labor, you know, the artist who's like drawing really beautiful clouds, he's you know, this is not going to help anyone exist. He's not doing it for sustenance. Yeah, it still falls under the category of labor. And so maybe we need a more robust understanding of what's meant by labor, because it's not simply struggling for existence, because there are certain kinds of work that are not that, but are labor. And so what is it about if for Nietzsche, you know, physical training for the sake of Olympic Games and military service, if that's not labor, then it would be good to understand why that is the case.
Yes. So Burkhardt here might be helpful, because Burkhardt's trying to give you the history without drawing philosophical conclusions. And so I think he sees the distinction as less essential. He's just kind of reporting on the fact that, yeah, these crafts where you're making something are undignified in the minds of the Greeks, whereas the contest is not. He says, by chance, the whole of representational art fell into the general category of banousia, meaning menial labor. To us latecomers, the art and poetry of the Greeks seem incontestably the highest and most marvelous of their achievements. And we naturally suppose the Greeks to have taken the same exalted view of art and artists. And he goes on, you know, temples and statues, paintings. These artists must have been venerated almost as supernatural beings, right? That's what he says. The reality was quite different. The sculptors themselves were subject to the harshest anti-banousic prejudices, and no sublimity of soul could redeem them. And here's the important part. I think if you're trying to understand the Greek mind, no sublimity of soul could redeem them from the fact that they earned their livelihood. That's the big thing, is they're making money. So I guess that's a big important distinction from the agon and the artist. You're not making money from the Olympics. They earned their livelihood, and that they wielded the chisel or stood at the anvil. So they're using a tool to make something, and in so doing, making money. And he says, look, even in the Iliad, the artist among the gods was not only lame from his fall, but also depicted as physically deformed in the very way that was considered typical of the banousos. Hephaestus is a broad-chested giant with powerful shoulders, but with lame and feeble legs. And so he's this kind of pathetic figure because he works.
So then what makes it labor is, still, it falls within the struggle of existence. That's how Burkhardt is painting it.
Because you're making money.
If you had this Olympian artist that is doing the same sort of work, but he's not doing it for the sake of money, because, you know, he has means due to the existence of slavery, then that doesn't count as labor.
I think Burkhardt actually talks about a case like this, where you have, I can't remember who it was, but a sculptor who he kind of knows, like, yeah, everyone looks down on me, even though I'm a great sculptor. So he starts like sculpting for free. And so he goes to the Olympics, and the custom is if you win, you can like commission a statue of yourself or an ode. And so this is like Pindar's Odes, celebrating these athletes. And so he goes and does it for free. He's like, I don't want money, because only slaves work for money. And so he's trying to kind of thread the needle of dignified labor, and can only, I'm not sure, who knows what the Greeks actually thought about this guy, but I doubt it totally worked, but maybe it sort of worked. And again, you can't approach this as like the Greeks sat down and wrote a metaphysics of work and then said, here are the necessary and sufficient conditions for living a life of dignity and not. This is, Burckhardt says, kind of by accident, this is what grows up. But of course, it's Nietzsche who's trying to build some sort of philosophical framework on it. Going back to the cry of compassion, tearing down the walls of culture, one surprise is we learn Nietzsche's favorite book of the Bible. You remember?
Oh, yes.
So he's talking about compassion. So on the one hand, compassion is this war against culture, but sometimes the flowering of compassion in a culture actually does produce good art.
So we get the gospel according to John.
That's right. A rainbow of compassionate love and of peace appeared with the first radiant rise of Christianity, and under it was born Christianity's most beautiful fruit, the gospel according to St. John.
Nietzsche wants you to read the gospel according to St. John. That's...
You should sign up for Ancient Greek class at the Ancient Language Institute, learn how to read New Testament Greek, and then you can read Nietzsche's favorite book of the Bible.
But it's going to take some labor to get there. Although you're not going to get paid for it, so maybe it's not labor.
No, certainly not. Certainly not. This is true leisure. You're paying for it.
Right. You can become. You too can be an Olympian. Sign up today.
That's right. So here's a great passage that kind of moves the argument along and is also a bit inscrutable. Maybe you can help me exegete it here, Jonathan. This is after his discussion of compassion's war against culture and this kind of exception of the Gospel of John. Therefore, we may compare this grand culture with a blood-stained victor who, in his triumphal procession, carries the defeated along as slaves chained to his chariot, slaves whom a beneficent power has so blinded that, almost crushed by the wheels of the chariot, they nevertheless still exclaim, "Dignity of labor! Dignity of man!" So pausing here, I want to keep reading, but pausing here, the image is culture is this devourer and slave master, or it's a triumphant general, you know, in his chariot, processing through Rome up to the Temple of Jupiter on the Capitol, leading those he's conquered in train. And modern culture has deluded the slaves. You know, slaves everywhere know they're slaves, except in the modern world, which is still filled with slaves. But the slaves in the modern world think they're not slaves. And so they shout, "Dignity of labor, dignity of man," even as they're being led away in conquest. Does that sound right so far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then he says, "The voluptuous Cleopatra culture throws ever again the most priceless pearls, the tears of compassion for the misery of slaves, into her golden goblet. Out of the emasculation of modern man has been born the enormous social distress of the present time. Not out of the true and deep commiseration for that misery. And if it should be true that the Greeks perished through their slavedom, then another fact is much more certain, that we shall perish through the lack of slavery." So here's where I need help. Cleopatra culture drinking pearls out of her goblet. It's the slaves, modern slaves shouting about the dignity of labor, but in fact, we don't have slaves and we'll perish for the lack of it. I'm not sure I totally follow what he's saying.
What I think would be worth starting with is his ending phrase. Like, what is he getting at with, "We're going to perish due to the lack of slavery"? What does that mean? Because does he mean that if there are no slaves, we're not going to produce enough food?
No.
So what are they doing that makes this? Because I took it that, you know, you need slaves so that people can be freed up from the burden of struggling for existence. And so I took that to mean, okay, so we need,
right,
basically we need to be able to produce enough food, right, so that we can have a class of people that's not like laboring to sustain its existence.
Right.
So he can be meaning different things. But it seems like, and the initial discussion, you need something that frees you up from the need to pursue the means for existence. And So if let's just start with an if he means the same thing here, it's like, you know, we need slaves so that we can do this. You know, otherwise we're going to go back to needing, everybody's going to be struggling for existence if we don't have slavery, then that seems like it's no longer the case, or it's just not the case due to the way in which we can pursue agriculture and food production, things like that. So it's been kind of, we can say, technologically proven wrong, if that's what he's getting at. But if he's trying to make a different statement, then what would it be?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's clear because there's no other concern in this essay about, like, GDP, so to speak. Like, the essay is not written because Nietzsche is worried about, like, you know, how do we preserve human existence? In fact, he kind of hates it. It's like, what kind of state policy do we need to ensure optimal food production? This is not his concern.
Yeah.
His concern is something else.
Well, what is certainly his concern is having a class that is not laboring for the sake of existence. And we can call that class slavery. We can call it farmers, you know, call it whatever you want. But the point that Nietzsche has in mind is they are just like the plants. There's nothing special about them. And yet they are the necessary condition for there to be few Olympian men.
Yeah.
So the Olympian men are dependent upon the laboring class. And if you don't have the laboring class, you don't have the Olympian men. It seems like that is one of his concerns. And so if you take your kind of tiered reading, if you don't have the laboring class, you don't have the producers of culture. And so then you don't have the Olympian men. Is that what he means? You take away this first rung of the ladder and it all falls apart.
Yes. No, that'll make sense. But then the question is, what connection does that have to the present? Like, what is he worried about happening literally in 19th century Europe? And he's focused on the lack of slavery, but of course, slaves don't make themselves slaves, right? Masters make slaves. And so I think what he's concerned about is this war of compassion against culture, where the privileged class, which still exists, it's not like privilege vanished because of compassion. The privileged class is as deluded as the slaves. They're both shouting, dignity of labor, dignity of man. And so the masters aren't ruling as masters. And therefore, they don't understand what's going on. They're unwilling to admit they're in charge, that they're on top, that they're exploiting the many. And so they won't, even though you have the misery of existence that's common to all human societies everywhere, you don't get the fruit, you don't get the culture, because these people aren't concerned about it. And in fact, not only are they not concerned about it, they hate it. They're waging war on culture and on classical antiquity.
Yeah, so then one way to think about the concern is, from Nietzsche's perspective, this obsession with dignity of man, dignity of labor, paralyzes the class that should be Olympian.
Correct.
And it's like, no, look, they're doing their part so that this small class can be Olympian. So instead of doing these humanitarian gestures, be Olympian.
Right. Yeah. They've been so poisoned by whether it's liberalism or socialism or communism to delude themselves and their slaves, so nobody knows what's going on.
So that seems like a fair read of what Nietzsche's up here. Is there anything else that you think he wants to push for?
I think that the second half of the essay is kind of a reiteration of his argument in more detail, particularly, and it has some of the best passages, in my opinion, but we can move through it quickly because I think we've hit the central moves he's making. And so he gives you a kind of more of a timeline, or not timeline, but a flowchart of how it happens. is like, okay, you want to, he's like, I brought you this far. So now you agree with me, right? That we need slaves. So how do we get slaves? Listeners, hang with us. All we're doing is explicating Nietzsche. I do not speak in my own voice, not advocating anything.
Yeah.
Says, okay, you want slaves? How do you get it? The Greeks, in their instinct relating to the law of nations, have betrayed it to us. In an instinct, which even in the ripest fullness of their civilization, humanity never ceased to utter as out of brazen mouth such words as, to the victor belongs the vanquished, with wife and child, life and property. Power gives the first right, and there is no right, which at bottom is not presumption, usurpation, violence. So, he's saying, how you get slaves is through the action of politics. And Greek political philosophy tells you how politics works. Might makes right. You know, Thrasymachus, Callicles, this is true Greek political philosophy. And that's how you create a slave, through a tyrant, through a conqueror. And that conqueror enslaves those he can and creates the state in order to hold them in place. The state is able, because it's able to maintain a slave class, that society gives birth to culture. And that's where you get the quote I read at the beginning. What is the excuse that the Greek city-state has for its seeming barbarism? The state steps before the tribunal of eternal justice, and by the hand it leads the flower of blossoming womanhood, Greek society. It was for this Helen that the state waged those wars. And it's through this culture, the production of art, that the Greek city produces the genius. And that's really the high point of this whole process, is conquers and makes slaves and builds the state in order to maintain his conquest, in order ultimately to produce the genius. And that was really the focus of Homer's contest. The previous preface we read is the Greeks were obsessed with competition in order to produce geniuses. And one of the chief dangers they faced was the production of a single genius. They needed many geniuses competing with each other to always keep the competition ongoing.
No, they didn't want a true Olympian.
Yes. And then he develops that argument and then turns kind of again. This is why I think it's kind of a repetition of the essay, but with kind of more detail and fleshing out the argument. And he turns back again to the modern world. Liberalism has created this kind of elite class that is not operating according to instinct, because it's really important for Nietzsche for people to believe in the state, even though the state has these kind of horrible, bloody origins of just the strong exploiting the weak. Great deeds are done for the sake of the state. That's how you produce this culture. But liberalism produces this elite class that has kind of opted out of state instinct, and they just kind of manipulate politics, and they don't have any real loyalty to a city, just in order to accumulate wealth. And this is what produces liberalism, rationalism, French Revolution, all of which is this attempt to manage jealousy and envy, which was one of the big subjects of Homer's contest. And so instead of envy driving great men to do greater and greater things, if we can just manage it all and create this kind of artificial peace, then these people can live comfortably, but nothing good is ever created. And so Nietzsche finally comes to his conclusion, which is the only remedy is war. And once again, war. War is Apollo, the true divinity for consecrating and purifying the state. War is just as much a necessity for the state as the slave is for society. And who can avoid this verdict if he honestly asks himself about the causes of the never-equaled Greek art perfection? So, war is like slavery, in that it's the brutal reality that preserves the health of the, you might call the parasite. So the Olympian class is a parasite on the slaves, but the Olympic, this parasite is really beautiful. And so it's worth it in Nietzsche's mind. Similarly, the state is this kind of, is what enables the privileged class to exist. It's this kind of beautiful thing, but it can only exist with war. And so if we go back to war, we'll create a military caste with a military genius, and this will give a rebirth to the state, which in turn will create a rebirth of a privileged class that can actually push culture forward. In the very end, I'll read two things. So he gets into just reiterating his point that the state exists in order to create genius. So he says, the proper aim of the state, the Olympian existence and ever-renewed procreation and preparation of the genius, compared with all the other things, are only tools, expedients, and factors towards realization, is here discovered with a poetic intuition and painted with firmness. Here, what does he mean? He's talking about Plato's Socrates' City and Speech in Plato's Republic. The ideal state, what Plato's actually talking about in the mouth of Socrates, is you build this state that seems horrifying. And he's like, well, yeah, it is horrifying, but you need horrifying things in order to produce excellent things. And you create this horrifying society in order to create geniuses. And this, he says, is the esoteric doctrine of Plato. Now, there's his argument in a nutshell, I think.
Yeah, no, I think we gave him a fair shake. It's a fair reading of this preface to an unwritten book.
So, yeah, you wanted to make the argument, and now you want to criticize.
Yeah, there are a few things. So I'll start with a blatantly unfair criticism.
Sure.
Which is as a piece that's making historical arguments, I found myself just asking over and over again, okay, can you give me a quote? You know, can you give me a statement from the Greeks supporting this? Just a general thing. Now, again, so this is a preface and it's also for an unwritten book. So it's like, maybe that's a big ask. Maybe this is the sort of thing that you would see in the full work. But still, I want to see some sort of more historical support.
Oh, I think it's absolutely a good instinct to have. And I think even if it doesn't amount, given the genre of the piece, even if it doesn't amount to a criticism of Nietzsche, it's at least a way forward. Like, okay, for someone who's interested in the argument, let's think about, you know, can this be backed up? So I think this is a fruitful line of inquiry. So what are some examples of places where you're like, wow, interesting part of the argument. What does he have in mind? Do you have anything particularly?
Yeah, so even the central claim about labor being a disgrace, right? This is a pretty universal totalizing statement. So I'm just like, well, okay, let's see some quotes from Greeks, you know, because there's all sorts of Greek literature. So I would kind of expect like a litany of quotes just supporting it. So any sort of claim like that.
I mean, he quotes Plutarch.
Yeah, but like I said, my instinct would be like, I want to see a bunch of them because it's a universal statement about the Greeks, you know, writ large.
This is where I'd read Burckhardt because this is where Nietzsche's getting it from. And so, sure, yeah. Maybe if you read this as the preface to Burckhardt, then it's really helpful.
Right. And then also kind of retooled to the same concerned, but geared towards artists, like our artists, writers, you know, the writers of drama. Is their work, does everyone, do all the Greeks see their work as labor, like that, you know, that sort of labor that's undignified, that sort of question teased out historically as opposed to schematically. Those are some of the examples that I have in mind. And I think it's at least, like you were saying, a good impulse to have, because there is a lot of kind of intellectual history out there that has these really sweeping claims that are very evocative and powerful. And it's good, you know, whenever you get excited about a historical narrative, it's good to ask yourself, okay, well, what's the history what's the history behind a historical narrative? And like I said, blatantly unfair given the fact that this is a preface, right? But just, you know, kind of my own personal relationship with this preface. So that's my first critique. Then I think that there is a just profound metaphysical incoherence in this work, because existence itself does not have value. Then really anything else, that any sort of discussion about value, is totally subjective to, you know, whoever. It's like, okay, Nietzsche, that's your thing, but maybe somebody else has their idea of the Übermensch or the Olympian man. Then it doesn't really need to be grounded in reality and the reality of existence, because existence doesn't have intrinsic value.
Or if it has value, it's very small. It, like, sure, human life has as much value as a stunted plant.
Yeah.
That's not nothing, but it's something.
Yeah, it's just not great.
Right.
Right. And he's concerned with, you know, greatness, but I'm still really foggy as to, like, okay, given this first metaphysical step, well, is there an objective anchor to greatness? It doesn't seem like it. It's just, this is the stuff that Nietzsche likes. It's like, okay, you've articulated the stuff that you like in a really powerful way, and that's great, but, you know, you're critiquing the French for their unmetaphysical philosophy, but the alternative is, it seems to me, the Nietzschean alternative is like a metaphysically vacuous alternative. It's not, you just can't anchor it in something that's objective. It's anchored in the stuff that Nietzsche likes.
Well, you can't anchor what?
So when I say anchor, I mean, what are you grounding it in? What's the grounding? Is it just the stuff?
Grounding what in?
Oh, I'm saying that you...
What's your it?
I'm saying that you can't. I'm saying that Nietzsche can't.
No, I'm just not understanding what your it means. What's it? Grounding it. What's it? What are we grounding?
Oh, grounding the idea, for instance, the value of the Olympian man. Why is it an objective part of reality, or is it just stuff that Nietzsche likes? And the way that I read this is like, he is describing real stuff, but this is the real stuff that Nietzsche likes.
Oh, I think this goes back to where he talks about the state. To the victor belongs the vanquished. Power. That's what's real. And so it's a metaphysics of, you know, the strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. So what's real is when you can, and this is what Simone Weil, I mean, this is why I think Simone Weil is this kind of weird mirror image of Nietzsche, where the Iliad is a poem of force because it depicts what's really going on in human life, which is the ability of a man to turn another man into a thing. And Nietzsche just kind of says, yeah, that is what the Greeks are up to. And that's all of this greatness that you ascribe to them ultimately goes back to that, is force.
Yeah, but existence has no intrinsic value. So why does force have intrinsic value? That's what I'm wondering. It's like, okay, well, the most basic building block, the most basic ontological building block has no value in itself. And if that's your starting point, I just.
I mean, do you think he would say that force has intrinsic value?
So that I don't think he should, given his first premise.
No, I don't think he would. I don't think he's concerned about a category like that.
No, yeah. No, I think that's right. This is what leads me to think that this is just the stuff that Nietzsche likes. It seems to be more aesthetically grounded than ontologically grounded.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, and I mean, he would probably be skeptical of ontology. I'm not enough of a Nietzsche guy or a philosopher to really talk really confidently about this, but I would say he's like, ontology? What are you talking about? I'm talking about power, and either I crush you or you crush me. And look, when you crush, you can build something really awesome.
Yeah, right. That does seem to be his claim, although it seems to me like he is playing an ontological game, because his claim about existence, is it really true that existence has no intrinsic value? I don't think so. I disagree. I think that existence does have intrinsic value. And even some of the categories that he critiques, it's like, well, okay, dignity of man. Is there a way to understand this that if you accept the some sort of intrinsic value to existence, then do you have some sort of dignity of man as a rational animal, and from a Christian perspective, made in the image of God? There does seem to be some value there if you take those steps. And so it's like, well, yeah. So even if he is like, oh, ontology, not my thing. It's like, well, yeah, but the whole project is premised upon some pretty serious ontological commitments. So you can't just, brush it off, Nietzsche. That would be my contention here towards him.
Sure. Yes. I think what it comes down to, and it's just, this is the starting point. And you take one of two roads. And if you go down one road, you come to all these conclusions. And if you go down the other road, you come to all these different conclusions. And it's this question of right. What makes something right or wrong? Nietzsche would say, the ability to do it makes it right. And if you accept that with Thrasymachus and Callicles, these other, the proponents of might makes right, then you go down a certain path. And I think that path includes the preface known as the Greek state. And Nietzsche would argue the Greeks as a people. And the other path is no, there's a different way of determining right. If that's the case, then you can't accept what Nietzsche's saying, including his contention that existence has no value in itself. But I think that contention makes sense given his belief that power gives the first right. Because if victory gives me the right to the vanquished, and I can dispose of them how I wish, then yeah, there's no way to say existence is good. Like, I kill all the men. Their lives belong to me. I can do whatever I want with them. They don't have any value. Whereas if you say, oh, there's some outside standard of right that says you can't just kill people because you win. Why? Well, there's something good about being alive. There's something good about humans. And that's where I think that's the nub of this kind of ontological problem, is it's really before it's ontology, before it's metaphysics, it's a question of justice, at least the way Nietzsche has set it up. And I think it's a provocative way to think about this problem.
I mean, I think that, yeah, so the way that I think about that is the question about justice is a metaphysical question. It's an ontological question. So maybe you can tease out what you mean there. So what is right? So, if a human being has no intrinsic value, it's the same as a piece of paper, let's say. You destroy the human being, no harm.
That's what Nietzsche is saying, because it's like, yeah, it's, this slavery looks really terrible, but it's worth it because you get these Olympian men.
Right. So you have the question of justice, but the question is determined by particular metaphysical commitments. The answer to the question, right? It's like, this is just, that's the same as destroying paper. So might as well, break a few eggs to have an Olympian omelet. Why not?
Right, right, right. Well, I think the, you know, traditional response to the question does require that. The kind of response, the response to the tyrant says, well, let me make this metaphysical argument to you. And the tyrant is in a position of skepticism, saying, I mean, maybe we should do the Gorgias, talk about all this. Like, yeah, well, okay, law. What are you talking about, law? Who made the law? It's the military genius lead who arose out of a military caste. The tyrant made the law. That's where justice comes from. So you think you have these fancy ontological and metaphysical arguments about how to justify all this stuff. No, it all goes back to the tyrant again.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's a flabby concept of morality, because it's equating morality with law, which is simply a institutionalized and in some cases written out statement of what a particular society deems to be politically and socially acceptable or not. But before you even have law, you have the reality of moral knowledge and moral awareness. You know, you own, you know, the farmer has his sheep, the sheep get taken, and there is the reality, the farmer experiences this and believes it's wrong. And there's a strong chance that the thief understands, you know, this is not right, but I want the sheep, right? And so it's not like they didn't need a written law to understand this. This is just kind of how we intuitively, you know, Nietzsche talks about instinct. We can think of there being a real moral instinct that precedes and maybe even ends up in some instances leading to a written out law system.
But the Greeks clearly didn't. I mean, what do the Greeks do when they come to Troy? What does Odysseus and his men do when they're traveling back home? They're just pirates. Go around taking people's stuff. No big deal. It's only a big deal when they take the gods' stuff. They're not allowed to touch Apollo's bulls? I messed it up. But that's just because the gods are bigger tyrants than men, because the gods will crush you if you commit an act of hubris. So it doesn't seem that the ancient Greeks shared these instincts, so they must not really be instincts. I mean, I'm not actually making myself. I think you're ultimately right. And it's worth pointing out that this starting point, this intuition that Nietzsche has, that the starting point for all these questions is the question of right, which I think he's intuiting from, or he's seeing in Plato, is picked up also by C.S. Lewis. How does mere Christianity start? It starts with Lewis saying, you know, when someone cuts you in line, you say, hey, that's not right. You can't take my place in line. Or she got a slice of orange, I should get one too. What is this outside law everyone's appealing to? So Lewis starts there. You're making the Lewis argument. I think this is the only possible response to Nietzsche.
I think there are others. I just think it's intrinsically, on its own, it's just an expression of preference. So if we're just dealing with expressions of preference, then de gustibus non disputandum est. It's like, wait, we're just talking preference? Oh, let's just have a beer instead.
Right. But, I mean, don't you think that plays right into Nietzsche's hands to say, it's a question of preference? He says, yeah, and the preference of the powerful is to subjugate the weak.
So yeah, so my contention is that if the game that Nietzsche is playing is correct, where we just have expressions of preference, then I mean there doesn't even need to be a response. It's like, oh, that's your preference, that's great. Slave morality has a different preference. you know the Persians have a very different preference. Whatever, right? It's just different preference. So that just makes it such that internally, like, okay, let's accept these parameters.
then if that's the kind of realm of the competition, then there's no winner, in my opinion, and my read of this. If we take it to be kind of like a struggle over ontology, right, you know, who's right about the nature of being, then there's a robust dispute that transcends mere preference.
Sure. Oh yeah, definitely. It's funny, the objection to this kind of totalizing view of the Greeks on the indignity of labor. Yeah, it'd be nice to have lots of quotes. Nietzsche just says, it's everywhere. It's like, okay. But Eliot accepts this. He's like, yeah, that's how the Greeks thought. And that's the part of the basis of his preference for the Romans over the Greeks. He says, this is from Virgil in the Christian World. It was the Greeks who taught us the dignity of leisure. It is from them that we inherit the perception that the highest life is the life of contemplation. But this respect for leisure with the Greeks was accompanied by a contempt for the Bonausic occupations. Virgil perceived that agriculture is fundamental to civilization, and he affirmed the dignity of manual labor. When the Christian monastic orders came into being, the contemplative life and the life of manual labor were first conjoined. So this is just really interesting. Eliot says, yeah, the Greeks disparaged labor. Virgil had a more balanced view, and the Christians put these two things together. You know, the Romans never really developed their own philosophical tradition. It's all just kind of borrowed from the Greeks. At least this would probably be Eliot's argument. And it's the Christians who are able to synthesize the two in the monastery. And so it just to kind of look back on a previous episode. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, I think one of the things that this essay should make us question is the state of the arts. You know, are we producing great art? Are cultural artifacts great? Is our architecture great? And I think that there's some answers to these questions, but I think we should be thinking about this. It's like, well, if not, why not? Why is architecture so terrible? Why are there so many Marvel movies? like catastrophic, devastating questions like that need to be asked. And we should also, it also leads to the realization that material wealth is not sufficient for producing anything great. Like, we have so much material wealth, way more than the material wealth of civilizations that created amazing cathedrals, amazing palaces. Why do we build so much crap? You know, wealth is not sufficient. It seems like this pushes the question to the realm of culture, which is what Nietzsche discusses here. So those are some of my concluding thoughts in terms of this. What sort of culture do we need in order to produce great things? And even if, you know, you don't have to buy, and I don't, as it's been clear, I don't buy the whole Nietzschean narrative here, but there does need to be an answer to those questions.
And I do think there's something true about compassion's war on culture, and more specifically classical antiquity, which he names here, because the study of the Greeks and Romans and their veneration have been over and over and over again the fuel for Renaissance. Obviously, the capital R Renaissance, which, interestingly, Burckhardt, who we've been talking about, what he's more known for, so I'm talking about his book, Greeks and Greek Civilization, what he's more known for is his book on Renaissance Italy. And he has a section or a chapter in there called The State as a Work of Art. So clearly thinking along similar lines to Nietzsche. But so whether it's the Renaissance proper, whether it's neoclassicism or German Hellenism or the kind of 12th century Renaissance in France, these are always looking back to a classical antiquity that create this rebirth of art and culture. And so there must be something about the hatred and marginalization and the kind of compassionate reinterpretation of the Greeks and Romans that stifles cultural development. And I think that's absolutely true, even if we don't want to affirm the kind of Callicleian analysis of justice. Well, with that, thanks for joining us. Check out some of the links below to read for yourself whether we've gone too far or if we're interpreting this right. Would love to hear back if you have any feedback or thoughts, and would of course love reviews and to subscribe and check out what we're doing. Thanks so much. Talk to you next time.